Democrats dance, GOP tax plans advance, and Facebook concedes Russian plants. And yes, Virginia, there is the political junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It was a big night for the Democrats on Tuesday, especially in Virginia, where some had thought the GOP was gaining in the race for governor.
The polling had gotten closer toward the end. And there also was some grumbling among Democrats that they didn't think that Northam was running a very good campaign. So there was a certain amount of anxiety on the Democratic side that made it more suspenseful.
Meanwhile, Donna Brazile has gotten some heat with her new book about Hillary Clinton, the DNC, and 2016. We'll hear what she has to say about the criticism.
I used the words that my mother probably would not have approved, but I told my detractors to go to hell. I should have channeled Michelle Obama and say, when they go low, we go high.
And it was a half century ago when Dick Lugar began his political career in Indianapolis. He's seen his share of victories and defeats.
I remember appearing on one of the morning shows, and Mrs. Reagan, as I recall, was asked whether she had any thoughts about me. She said she didn't know me very well, and I thought, oh my, that's really a good sign.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 204 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It was a pretty remarkable sight on Tuesday. Democrats who had been despondent since last year's election found reason to celebrate, as limited as the 2017 contests were. Still, they swept all three statewide offices in Virginia, took back the New Jersey governorship, won a landslide in New York City, and ousted Republican mayors in Manchester, New Hampshire, Atlantic City, and elsewhere. Manchester got its first female mayor, as did Charlotte, North Carolina. St. Paul, Minnesota elected its first black mayor. In Helena, Montana, there's an African-American mayor for the first time in the state's history. That's a beaut. Seattle elected its first openly gay mayor. A transgender candidate not only was elected to the state legislature in Virginia, but she unseated a prominent anti-gay conservative who had been in office 26 years. And the boyfriend of a TV reporter who was gunned down on live television defeated a Republican incumbent in Virginia who had an A rating from the NRA. If you listen to the way Democrats responded to Tuesday's results, it sounded like the Trump presidency was nearing its end. We'll have a lot more to say about Virginia coming up on the program. Meanwhile, in New Jersey, Phil Murphy, the Democrat elected after 8 years of Chris Christie, said his victory was a repudiation of Trump.
With Donald Trump in the White House, Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, polluters running the EPA, zealots heading the Department of Education, and Steve Bannon holding Republicans in Congress hostage, governors will have never mattered more.
And New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, who was reelected in a landslide, had a similar message.
America got a little fairer tonight. America got a little bluer tonight. Let's cheer so they can hear us in New Jersey. Let's cheer so they can hear us in Virginia. And tonight, New York City sent a message to the White House as well.
Of course, these victories, as exciting as they were for Democrats, may not tell us anything about what may happen in next year's congressional midterm elections, and certainly not the presidential race in 2020. But they do lead to this week's trivia question. When was the last time the off-year election results in Virginia, New Jersey, and New York City all went the same way and in opposition to the party in the White House? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. Poor Hillary Clinton. She lost an election few thought she would lose. She has been bombarded with insults from President Trump ever since, on Twitter, from the Rose Garden, everywhere. We've learned that Russia even used postings on social media to savage Clinton throughout last year's campaign. And this week, right before he embarked on his 12-day Asia trip, the president had this to say to reporters.
All I can tell you is this. There was no collusion. There was no nothing. It's a disgrace, frankly, that they continue. You ought to look at Hillary Clinton, and you ought to look at the new book that was just put out by Donna Brazil, where she basically bought the DNC, and she stole the election from Bernie. So that's what you ought to take a look at.
It was the last thing Democrats want to talk about. Trump may not have gotten all the facts right, but here's what's going on. Donna Brazil, the longtime Democratic strategist, has a new book out in which she reportedly says that Hillary Clinton's campaign had a deal with the Democratic National Committee that gave her an unfair advantage during her primary battle last year with Bernie Sanders. Now, the allegation that the DNC favored Clinton over Sanders is not new. Hacked DNC emails 2 summers ago by Russia and published by WikiLeaks that purportedly said the same thing is what led to the ouster of party chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And it extended a feud between the Hillary and Bernie wings of the party that continue to this day. Brazil has been savaged by Clinton supporters who say that she has her facts wrong or that she's splitting the party at a time when it should be united in the fight against Trump. So there's probably no better time than now to have Donna on the Political Junkie. Donna Brazil, it's great having you on the program.
It's a great honor to talk with you. And as you well know, I, too, am a political junkie.
Yes, I do know that. And look, before we go any further, give me a reaction to Tuesday's big Democratic victories in Virginia, New Jersey, and elsewhere.
Well, let me just say this. Like James Brown, the godfather of soul, I feel good. I feel good that we had a 5% jump in turnout over 2013. I feel good that we had candidates on the bottom of the ticket win as well as candidates on the top of the ticket. I feel good that this wasn't just an inside the Beltway campaign, but it was a grassroots campaign. It was fueled by those who wanted to take their seats at the table. We had new energy, new blood, fresh faces, and it was a victory not just for Democrats, but it was a victory for grassroots activism all across the country, from Maine, where 89,000 people now will have access to health care if the governor will only cooperate, to new mayors in many, many cities across the country, to looking at Democrats in red states come back from what I like to call a deficit or a drought.
Okay, now to your book. It's called Hacks, the inside story of the break-ins and breakdowns that put Donald Trump in the White House. What was the story you wanted to say?
I took on the chairpersonship of the Democratic Party after it was revealed that our party was hacked, after we saw thousands of internal documents released to the press. This was the second time in my life that I've served this chair, and I wanted to focus on how the party can learn the lessons for the future. There's an open wound in our party, and the only way to heal any open wounds, I believe, is to address it. I think the party has to discuss what happened, all of it, so that we can heal and unite and move forward stronger. So the purpose of writing the book, and, you know, I go from chapter 1 to chapter 20, where I describe the hacking of the DNC. I describe my own personal experiences as chair of the DNC and the struggles and some of the pitfalls I face. And I also describe my interactions with the candidates, both on the Democratic side and others, as well as how we had to stand up against the Russian aggression.
There's a difference, in my view, there's a difference between a party preferring a particular candidate and a party rigging the process. So one, is there a difference? And two, where do you think the DNC was in the Hillary versus Bernie contest?
You know, I've had a hard time because I know Donald Trump is famous for saying that the process is rigged. The process is rigged. And what I wanted to find out, because I promised Bernie and I promised those at the convention that as chair of the party, I would get to the bottom of whether or not there was any rigging that took place. And in my examination, I found an addendum to a joint fundraising agreement. A joint fundraising agreement is a document that candidates signed. I mean, we can go back to 2004 when John Kerry became the nominee. Essentially, starting up committees where you have the state party, say you have the Louisiana State Party, goes into an agreement with the Democratic National Committee and the Kerry campaign to execute the campaign strategy. That's everything from paying the rent to buying ads on television. And what I found was something that went beyond a standard agreement between the political party and the candidates and the state parties. This was an additional memorandum of understanding between Robbie Mook and Amy Dacey that was CC'd to the lawyers that gave the Clinton campaign in exchange for helping the DNC raise money and to help the DNC pay down its debt. The Clinton campaign would effectively help with the communications, the strategy, the investment, and the research. And so when I refer to what broke my heart in the book, and I think I tried to be as straight as possible, I said it broke my heart that this agreement was in effect before the nominee was selected. Because while I found no evidence of rigging, what I found was this agreement prevented the Democratic Party from doing its job. And my job as chair was going to be difficult because of this agreement. So I found this and identified it as a cancer, because the control of the party should never go toward the nominee, even for research or technology, until the process is over with. But as you saw in the agreement, because it's now public, it also said that it would apply only to the general election. I found evidence that it applied prior to the general election, and that's what I tried to discuss with Bernie.
That leads to the obvious next question. Do the Sanders people have a case that they were not treated fairly by the party?
I mean, the Sanders people will likely make that case, but I can also make the case that in my examination, I found no evidence that any of the primaries were rigged. I found no evidence that any departments that work with state parties on caucuses and anything else, I found no evidence of anything. I found no evidence that the research was on Sanders or any campaign ads were spent on Sanders. What I found was, as I stated, that some of the early decisions in the legal department and the research department that went along the lines of setting up operations for the fall started long before the primary was over. Our primary went all the way to June 7th, when the people of New Jersey and California and many other states cast their ballots. And while Secretary Clinton had a large lead in elected delegates, she also won by more than 4 million votes. She won 3 out of the 4 of the first contest, 9 out of 10 African-American votes. I mean, she was the front runner throughout most of the primary. But Sanders had a very strong, a very energetic. He won key states as well across the country. He brought a lot of delegates to the convention. And I thought that the process, while it was open to candidates from all different backgrounds to participate in, the DNC got involved in a memorandum of understanding that I did not like. And I said to them that had I known as vice chair this was going on, I would have objected to it, but I didn't know. And I found it and I called it cancer. And I that's the only way to describe it.
You became acting DNC chair after Debbie Wasserman Schultz was forced out. What was the situation with the party? What was it like at that time?
Oh, Ken, I left ABC that morning. I did a TV show. I was a commentator on ABC and CNN, of course. And I was just doing my usual, convention duties, which was going around to speak to caucuses and state parties. And I received a call, and I was told that it was likely that Debbie would step down. And my first reaction was, oh, no, that meant that I had to step up at a time the party was under attack. The party was hemorrhaging money. The party was under a big, big, big cloud.
And about to have a national convention.
About to have a national convention. And in the back of my mind, I said, I can do this. I can do this. Because I thought, like many other Americans, just a few months of my life, it's going to inconvenience me. But you know what? I want to see Hillary win. I want to see a woman in the White House. And, you know, she had won the nomination. I wanted to see her win. And so I said, okay, I'll just quit everything and I'll just go back to being chair of the DNC. And that's what I did.
You said in your book that you found the Clinton campaign to be antiseptic, that it was lacking in passion. Did you talk to the campaign about that?
Every time I went, I tried to shake it up. I'm an old school kind of Democrat. Can I go back to my first campaign at the age of 9? So I like to hear, you know, noise. I like to hear people doing things that I can't see even on the radio. But I like to hear people, you know, being engaged, being active. It was not that kind of campaign, in my judgment. Everybody was on their cell phones. Everybody was on their little computers. It wasn't the kind of campaign that I was accustomed to seeing. Now, I'm referring to the headquarters in Brooklyn. I'm not talking about what I found in Clark County or Las Vegas or what I found in Mecklenburg County, which is Charlotte, or Cuyahoga County, which is Cleveland. No, I'm talking about the national headquarters. It was a little antiseptic, in my judgment. That maybe people are taking that as a criticism, but I just wanted to describe what it felt like to walk into the building. I felt like I was in a hospital. It was clean.
You mentioned you're a loyal Democrat. You've been with the party for decades, and I know that's true. What do you say to those who argue that you're bringing up dirty laundry when the party should be focused on Trump?
You know, I say to my friends who are telling me now that I should be focusing on Trump, I'm like, I don't know if you remember, but last year when we were getting the you-know-what kicked out of us because of the hacking, when my staff members, my colleagues were being harassed, when donors were being called at all hours of the night, where were these voices? How come they didn't put out a petition then? I've been told that this is the wrong time to tell troubling truths. Imagine if this book came out next year before the midterm elections or the year after when the 2020 cycle will be beginning. The year after a presidential election, Ken, is the best year for debate and dissent. And I had to relive what I experienced in the hope that nobody else has to experience it again.
So what's next for Donna Brazile now that you have half the party angry at you?
Well, let me tell you something. On Sunday, when I finished my last, who knows, but my last show on ABC as a commentator, I used the words that my mother probably would not have approved, but I told my detractors to go to hell. I should have channeled Michelle Obama and say, when they go low, we go high. I'm up at Harvard at the Shorenstein Center for Media Politics and Public Policy studying how the Europeans have reacted to the hacking by Russians and the Russian aggression in their elections. I want to make sure that the American people, my colleagues at the DNC, and even my Republican friends and others understand how to combat this type of aggression, because I'm afraid, as James Comey said earlier, that they will be back. And I want us to be prepared for the next hacking. This time they went after our electoral system. What if they went after our electrical grid or, God forbid, something else? You know, after receiving my FBI briefing on August 11th, I wanted to go over to the Pentagon. I was like, why am I going back to the DNC? I should be going to the Pentagon. This is war. It's war by a different means, but active measures to destabilize the country, to sow disinformation and discord, to attack Hillary Clinton and her campaign and her political party and not pay a price. I would hope that the American people will understand my book is not just about an old political hack who's been around the block maybe, you know, for 48 years, but this is about the future of our democracy and strengthening the various institutions so that this will never happen again.
Donna Brazile is the former interim chair of the Democratic National Committee. Her book, Hacks, the Inside Story of the Break-ins and Breakdowns that Put Donald Trump in the White House, came out this week. Donna, it was great having you on the program, and I still like you.
You know, Ken, I think those people, I think the friends and colleagues, they're probably disappointed, but I will remind them, but there's no one who's more disappointed. I spent months after the election trying to figure out if the emails I received from Donnie Fowler saying I need $150,000 from Michigan, would that amount of money in the last few days made a difference? I spent time thinking about Ed Rendell's request for $300,000 or G.K. Butterfield and Durham calling me about the polls not opening on time and getting a lawyer to help. I have spent so many months going through and ripping myself apart about what I could have done to prevent Donald Trump from being in the White House. And I came out of this with one major goal, and that was to help the next generation of Americans get back on the battlefield and win. And on Tuesday, November 7th, my heart leaped with joy. So I'm going to choose hope and choose action. That's who I am.
Donna, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ken. Talk to you again. God bless you and God bless your listeners.
The big news coming out of Tuesday's elections was the Democratic sweep in Virginia. Yes, Donald Trump lost the Old Dominion in 2016. And yes, Democrats already have the governorship, the lieutenant governorship, the attorney generalship, and both U.S. senators. But there were signs that the Republican candidate, Ed Gillespie, having moved to the right during the campaign, especially on immigration and heritage issues, was picking up steam. In the end, Democrats won all three statewide contests. Ralph Northam for governor, Justin Fairfax for lieutenant governor, and Mark Herring for attorney general. Northam, in fact, won by 9 points. This was, in a way, a status quo election. Nothing changed. But in other ways, it was a defining moment for the Democrats, who were still not over what happened in 2016. Janet Hook reported on the race for the Wall Street Journal and is here with her analysis. Janet, welcome, as always, to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the poll said Ralph Northam would win, and Ralph Northam won. So why were we so glued to the results Tuesday night? I mean, I know I was.
Well, one reason I was glued to the results is I learned from 2016 never to trust any poll. Like, so I really had no idea which way it was going to fall. And the polling, I think the reason why it was uncertain and why Democrats were worried is that the polling had gotten closer toward the end, you know, within the margin of error. And there also was some grumbling among Democrats that they didn't think that Northam was running a very good campaign, that he wasn't a great candidate. So there was a certain amount of anxiety on the Democratic side that made it more suspenseful than it might have been otherwise. And while it was sort of a status quo election, you didn't mention the aspect of the results that were totally surprising, which was that the Democrats almost and may yet take control of the House of Delegates in Virginia, because the state legislature is controlled by Republicans, even though all of the statewide offices were controlled by Democrats. And the other thing is that turnout was just through the roof, and that, as much as anything, seemed to be the thing that led people to think, wow, this is a different kind of election, even if you end up with a bunch of Democrats still at the top of the state.
I agree with you completely. In the beginning of our show, we talked about some of the surprises in the state legislative contest. I think as of this writing, they're up. The Democrats picked up 14. They needed 17, and there are some that are too close to call. So you're right, that could change, and that would be a big result as well. But in many ways, I think I was more interested in Gillespie's campaign. Look, you've been covering politics for a long time. You must remember him when he was pretty much an establishment Republican, and yet he was almost unrecognizable in the latter parts of this year's campaign.
Well, I actually think that Ed Gillespie on the stump was recognizable. He ran ads, though, that didn't seem very establishment Ed Gillespie-esque. And this points to the line that he was trying to walk. I mean, it was a tightrope of running in a swing state where the Republicans were very, you know, there were a lot of strong supporters of Trump. He had to choose between running against Trump, running with Trump, kind of trying to sound Trumpy while not campaigning with Trump. And so he tended to be, his ads were very focused on provocative, emotional Trump themes like crime and immigration. And his stump speeches actually were much more like, I'm hitting local notes. I'm going to focus on the economy of Virginia. There was this kind of schizophrenic quality. I mean, to be honest, I thought that given the predicament that he was in, he did about as good a job as a Republican could do to sort of sympathize with Trump's agenda without hugging Trump himself. But it's hard to do, and it didn't work.
Well, let me play one of those more Trumpian ads.
MS-13 appears to be surging again.
The dangerous street gang, MS-13, are responsible for the recent murder in Bedford County.
And those crimes have been increasing around our region.
MS-13 is a menace. Yet Ralph Northam voted in favor of sanctuary cities that let dangerous illegal immigrants back on the street, increasing the threat of MS-13. Ralph Northam's policies are dangerous.
I'm Ed Gillespie, candidate for governor, and I sponsored this ad for a safer, stronger Virginia.
You know, Jen, I agree with a lot of what you just said. I mean, given the way that Northern Virginia came out for Northam in such huge numbers, and given how unpopular Trump is in the state, I mean, I don't know what Gillespie could have done to have won the election.
Yeah, I mean, an ad like that may have helped him to galvanize and get the votes of the Trump voters, the people who supported Corey Stewart, who was his primary opponent. Corey Stewart, who almost beat Ed Gillespie. And, you know, it's funny. I was talking to somebody who was saying that the irony about Ed Gillespie is he seemed to have run a general election campaign during the primary and that was why he was almost beat by Corey Stewart and then had to kind of make up lost ground during the general election and run a kind of more provocative campaign to mobilize those voters. You know, Donald Trump can't win with him, can't win without him. You know, that was where he was. So what I don't know is, like, how many other states are coming up in the midterm elections that are like Virginia? Not too many. But I wonder whether his dilemma is the dilemma that will face incumbent House Republicans who are, you know, the battleground in the House is a bunch of swing districts where you've got the same question is, how do you position yourself vis-a-vis Donald Trump? It was thought that he was kind of writing the playbook for those Republicans. But if you get beat that bad, it's a playbook that you might want to scrap.
And then you also wonder what effect, if any, the Republican tax plan will have, because Republicans in states like New York, New Jersey and California, high tax states where there's so many deductibles that voters and taxpayers need to write off, that could imperil many Republicans in those states as well.
Yeah, I think that those California and New York Republicans who are looking at what happened have surely got to be even more cautious than they were before. In talking to Republicans on the Hill about what lessons they draw from the Virginia election, they do seem to come away with the idea that they are in trouble in the midterm elections. They know that. They knew it before, and they know it even more vividly now. And about the only solution they could think of is, well, now we really have to pass that tax bill. I mean, I think they feel incredibly vulnerable, in part because the Republican Congress hasn't managed to pass any of the marquee campaign promises. I don't know whether passing a tax bill will be enough to alleviate the political risks that they face, but that's one thing that they know they can't not do.
Did you happen to see what Trump tweeted about the results? He tweeted this: Ed Gillespie worked hard, but he did not embrace me or what I stand for. I mean, it's fair to say that, yes, he didn't invite Trump into campaign for him, but he did embrace many of his social issues, right?
Yes.
That's part of the dilemma you're talking about.
Right. And that sends a really unfortunate message to other Republicans about how willing Trump is to stand beside you. I mean, that was really throwing Ed Gillespie under a bus. You know, he lost, but it wasn't because my ideas and I am, you know, politically ineffective. I mean, he sent that out even before Gillespie had been able to give his concession speech. I mean, it was really kind of Trump trying to protect his own brand.
Lots of Democrats were telling me that they were fearful of what might happen in Virginia. And then Tuesday night, you know, they were saying it was the greatest night ever, that they were bouncing back, that Trump and the Republicans' days were numbered. That's a bit premature, isn't it?
Yes, we all tend to overread the significance of any particular election. In this case, though, I do think it would have been really bad for the Democrats if they hadn't been able to hold on to this governor's seat. I mean, it really, really would have portended poorly about their efforts to kind of capture the anti-Trump sentiment and channel it into electoral gains. If they had not won this, it would have been kind of a calamity. Having won it, I think the thing that is most telling and most relevant to elections going forward isn't just that they won this race with this candidate, but that there was such a high level of energy. I mean, we've talked and seen polls that point to an enthusiasm gap between Republicans and Democrats. But this is like facts on the ground, differences in motivation and energy among Democratic voters versus Republicans. I mean, it may be that that's going to be hard to sustain for a whole other year, but I don't know. So that seems to be kind of the challenge for the Democrats in the coming months and year, to make sure that that energy stays high and that it gets unified behind a candidate, and that it turns out in districts and state races all across the country, not just in this handful that were at stake on Tuesday.
But I was going to say, but at least for one night at least, when you look at what happened in Virginia, statewide as well as the legislature, and in New Jersey and New York City, cities around the country, it was a very good night for the Democratic Party.
It was a very good night for the Democratic Party. It would be a big mistake for them to think that they can anyhow rest on their laurels. And then not to mention, oh, who knows what happens after 2018. I don't think any of these races resolved the deeper question about what does the Democratic Party stand for? What kind of a message will they take to the voters in the presidential election? But that really gets ahead of ourselves.
Janet Hook is a political reporter with the Wall Street Journal who, like me, no longer fears turning on her TV set and watching all these awful commercials. They were awful, weren't they?
They were.
At least for now, anyway. Janet, thanks so much for being on the program.
You're welcome.
It was a dramatic moment that late night in July when John McCain appeared on the Senate floor and gave a thumbs down on the so-called skinny repeal and replace bill Republicans tried to advance that would kill Obamacare. His no vote made him the third Republican to break with his party, and it was enough to kill the bill. Long known as a maverick, he was also known as someone who often talked more about independence than voting that way. But on the health care bill, it was a clear example of choosing principle over party. That doesn't happen often. And when one thinks of a senator who was best known for choosing principle over party, you'd have to go back to the 1940s. Arthur Vandenberg was a longtime isolationist Republican senator from Michigan who later changed course and worked with Democratic presidents and lawmakers, and who is probably more responsible than anyone else to forge a bipartisan coalition that gave us the United Nations, the Marshall Plan, and NATO. Hank Meyer is a former reporter and editor and the author of a new book, Arthur Vandenberg, The Man in the Middle of the American Century. Hank Meyer, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks so much, Ken. Great to be with you.
Well, I don't think it would be an overstatement to say that in the beginning of his career, Arthur Vandenberg was one of the more staunch isolationists in the Senate.
No question about it. In fact, in 1939, he led the Senate fight to keep Franklin Roosevelt from repealing the arms embargo so that he could come to the aid of Great Britain as war loomed in Europe.
And then, you know, when World War II, you know, when the buildup to World War II was going on, he wanted no part of it, right?
Right. He resisted Roosevelt at every step, from opposing an end to neutrality to fighting Lend-Lease. He was not about to let Roosevelt drag us into war.
It wouldn't be fair to call him an American firster, would it?
He never belonged to that organization. He used that term before it took on its worst connotations. He would say that he was a nationalist, that he went from isolationism to internationalism, but all the time that was because America, too, was going from an isolated place to a place that had to lead the world and become international in its thinking, and that he evolved with that.
Talk a little bit, I mean, I mentioned in the intro about the Marshall Plan and other things like that. Talk a little about what he helped bring to the forefront of American foreign policy.
Sure. He had a sense that America could no longer retreat as it did after World War I. And Roosevelt had the good sense to say, much as I don't like this guy who fought me every step of the way through much of the New Deal, I can't not appoint him to the delegation of Americans at the founding of the United Nations in 1945. And then Roosevelt dies. Truman, of course, famously had lunch once with Roosevelt while he was vice president, basically had not been informed of the status of American foreign policy or the emerging rivalry with the Soviet Union. And Roosevelt had notoriously been his own State Department and done things through Harry Hopkins, not through the Secretary of State. So the American delegation arrives in San Francisco to help write the UN charter, and Vandenberg is the most important American delegate. He has the most stature in the government. He's the one that the administration knows they need to convince Republicans to go along with a new United Nations. And so it's Vandenberg facing down Molotov as the sort of the key power relationship in San Francisco. And then Vandenberg goes from there when George Marshall outlines the need to rebuild the economies of Western Europe that have been ravaged, devastated by the war, and leaving themselves vulnerable, perhaps, to communist influences. Vandenberg is approached by Marshall and says, we need to do this massive aid program. Vandenberg, of course, hems and haws and in good Republican fashion says this is too expensive, but sits down with Marshall. Truman has the good sense to say, we got to call this the Marshall Plan. If we call the Truman Plan, it'll never sell, but Marshall is revered, respected. We'll put his name on it. Marshall came to say, you know, it could have been called the Vandenberg Plan, because once it got to Congress, Van was the whole show. And so it was Vandenberg's engineering, Vandenberg's patient taking of testimony. I think it was probably the lengthiest hearing ever held in Congress, listening to everyone say what should be in, what should be out of the Marshall Plan. And it was Vandenberg who put it through the Senate.
Well, here's a little piece of tape of Vandenberg talking about the Marshall Plan.
If it can succeed, it will help stop World War III before it starts. It will prevent America's isolation in a communist world. It is a plan for peace, stability, and freedom. As such, it involves the clear self-interest of our own United States. It can be the turning point in history for 100 years to come. If it fails, we have finally done our best. If it succeeds, our children and our children's children will call us blessed. May God grant his benediction upon this ultimate event.
Hank, if nothing else, you could say he did have a vision for what he saw in the Marshall Plan.
That's terrific, and that vision has held for 70 years now.
I know his name was mentioned several cycles as a potential presidential candidate. Did he want the job? I think from gathering what I read in your book, it sounds like he wanted it, but he didn't want to campaign for it.
Right. He definitely wanted it. He was very conscious of it. In fact, in 1940, he was expected by many Democrats included to be the Republican nominee. And in fact, in 1938, Franklin Roosevelt opened an FBI office in his hometown of Grand Rapids, Michigan. And the agent assigned there told the editor of the local newspaper that the reason he was there was to keep an eye on Arthur Vandenberg. But in 1939, war breaks out in Europe. And the isolationist position that Vandenberg had been the most vocal supporter of began to be discredited. People began to say, no, there is a threat here from Nazi Germany. And so along comes Wendell Willkie, and who really was a Republican in name only, but had a foreign policy outlook that was closer to Roosevelt's and represented a fresh look in a party that through the Depression and through running up to World War II was looking pretty tired. And he swept past Vandenberg, Taft, a young prosecutor named Thomas Dewey, and swept for the nomination. And then in 1948, Vandenberg was again mentioned as a leading candidate. But at that point, his wife had cancer. He may have had intimations of his own illness. And he had such stature in the Senate that I don't think he necessarily had the fire in his belly to really go after it.
I also read in your book about allegations of, shall we say, indiscretions. Did that play a role in anything? Did people talk about that back then?
They absolutely did. In fact, Walter Winchell, in a radio broadcast, talked about that. Vandenberg had an affair with the wife of a Canadian diplomat at the British Embassy, and her name was Mitzi Sims. And Walter Winchell described Vandenberg as the senator from Michigan.
And it's very likely.
As one old reporter said to me, well, you know, the British planted her on Vandenberg just like they planted Kay Summersby on Ike. That presumably she was there to at least find out what the isolationists were thinking. This is in 1939, 1940, and arguably could have had a persuasive effect. I think Pearl Harbor and his nephew and changing times were much more decisive in his evolution, but it certainly didn't help his political chances, and there's a very good chance that would have been dragged up again come 1948.
Hank Meyer is the author of the new book, Arthur Vandenberg, The Man in the Middle of the American Century. Hank, it was a fascinating read, and it was great having you on the program.
Ken, thank you so much.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last top campaign or administration official who received a presidential pardon? The answer? We're going back to the Clinton administration for this one, Bill, not Hillary. We'll take either Henry Cisneros, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, who pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI and was fined $10,000, or John Deitch, the director of the CIA, who pleaded guilty for mishandling government secrets discovered on his laptop computers after he left the agency. President Clinton pardoned them both. And so the randomly selected winner is Jay Lapidus of West Hartford, Connecticut, who answered with Cisneros. Jay wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com.
I beg your pardon. I never promised you a rose garden along with the sunshine. There's gotta be a little rain sometime.
It's time for This Week in Political History. As the chief executive of Indianapolis, he was known as Richard Nixon's favorite mayor. He parlayed that into six terms in the U.S. Senate. He became chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and was a widely respected voice on foreign policy. The longest-serving senator in Indiana history, Lugar was upset in the 2012 Republican primary by Richard Murdoch. After he left the Senate, he created the Lugar Center, a nonprofit organization that focuses on foreign aid and nuclear nonproliferation. But with his first election as mayor of Indianapolis coming 50 years ago this week, it was as good a reason as any to bring him on the program. Dick Lugar, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Well, thank you very much, Ken. I really appreciate the honor of being with you.
There's so much to talk about when you talk about Dick Lugar's political career, starting 50 years ago. But let me start 50 years ago. You've forever been saddled with the label Nixon's favorite mayor. And it's hard to get away with that. I guess at some point it was an honor and some point it may not have been. How did you respond to those things?
Well, as a matter of fact, I was pleased to have opportunities to visit the White House with some frequency. And this is what led David Broder of Washington Post to say, Lugar is in and out of the White House so often, he surely must be Nixon's favorite mayor. Let me just indicate that one reason why I was in and out was that I had been elected president of the National League of Cities, and likewise vice chairman of the Intergovernmental Advisory Board. Nelson Rockefeller, as I recall, was the governor who was chairman of that at that time. And it was a busy time in terms of intergovernmental relations, to say the least, and one of great activity at the local, state, and the federal levels.
As the leader of that city of Indianapolis, you were always listed as one of the top mayors in the country. And I think that led you to start thinking about higher office. Is that fair to say?
Well, I was interested in higher office because, unfortunately, I was term limited to just 8 years of service as mayor. But I wanted to serve the 8 years and then potentially campaign for the United States Senate the following year after I left the office. It didn't work out that smoothly because the Republican Party statewide wanted a candidate to run against Senator Birch Bayh in my seventh year as mayor.
And this is 1974.
Yeah. I argued that I was really not eager to do that. And they said, whether you're eager or not, you've got to do that for the benefit of the party. We're in trouble because President Nixon's troubles, as a matter of fact, the polls were staggeringly against any Republican. And
we're talking about 1974 in the midst of the Watergate scandal.
That's right. And there was a time after President Nixon resigned that we miraculously began to move from about 14 points down to even during the summertime, finally lost by 4 points ultimately. But it turned out that the campaign was one in which I was able to establish a statewide identity, which certainly we did not have. I was well known within 50 miles of Indianapolis at that time, but statewide not so. So this meant the campaign against Senator Vance Harkey in 76 was much easier, and we won really fairly easily at that point.
I was going to say that was a landslide election. You know, but the first convention I ever attended was the 1980 Republican convention in Detroit, and I don't know why I was convinced that you were going to be Ronald Reagan's running mate. Did you think you had a shot? Did you meet with Reagan about the possibility of being his running mate, and did you want the job?
I did not meet with him, but to be truthful, I was hopeful that I would be selected. My staff was very active at that point, and the rumors were rampant. And
I was convinced you were going to be the running mate. I was convinced of it.
When I came to Detroit, why the press came out and chased me all the way through the airport and so forth. It was one of those situations in which I remember appearing on one of the morning shows, and Mrs. Reagan, as I recall, was asked whether she had any thoughts about me, and she said she didn't know me very well, and I thought, oh my, that's not a good sign.
That's not helpful, right?
But it was an exciting period of time.
And I still have my Reagan Luger picture buttons from that convention.
Oh, bless your heart.
But 8 years later, when you were all, your name was also mentioned, of course, you were up for re-election in 1988, but it was Dan Quayle of Indiana who was picked as running mate in 1988, who was fairly new to the Senate and didn't have your depth of experience. Was that a disappointment to you?
Yes, I was disappointed. I had heard once again lots of rumors as I was headed to the convention, why everybody on the plane was excited. And I remember heading out to various delegation meetings at the instruction of the convention managers and so forth. And while I was out at one of these meetings, I heard that, in fact, Dan Quayle was coming down the Mississippi River or something of that sort, and was apparently going to meet the president to be on the shoreline there and be named.
Right, Vice President Bush.
Yeah.
Well, you know something, you talk about the bumpy road that Dan Quayle had when he was first picked as George H.W. Bush's running mate in 1988. Let me play something from when you decided you wanted to run for president as well. This is 1995, your campaign announcement.
As president of the United States, I will establish a new foundation for American optimism and strength. Together, we will exercise and enjoy the American advantage. And that advantage is our unique ability to build a new economic future for ourselves and for our families, to assert strong and creative American leadership in the world, and to reinvigorate our traditional values of religious faith, of family, honesty, and integrity. Americans want a leader they can trust.
You know, it goes without saying, you were one of the most respected of all the senators. Your knowledge and expertise in foreign policy was second to none. But as you know, and I'm sure as you knew at that time, you were giving that speech, announcing your candidacy for president, not long after the horrific bombings in Oklahoma City. That had to take away some of the luster of a campaign announcement, didn't it?
Well, it certainly did. First of all, the tragedy in Oklahoma City dominated the press altogether. What might have been at least some coverage of my rally in front of the city county building in Indianapolis was simply lost in the process. And many of my friends in the press felt sad about that, that their stories really had not been placed, but that's the way it turned out. it was just a rather awesome and unfortunate beginning of a campaign.
And let me, I just want to play a little bit of a campaign commercial for your presidential candidacy.
Political ads don't really say much, except about character.
I'm disgusted with the nasty politics.
Because we've got candidates that are just hacking away at each other.
Everybody else was slinging mud and seemed to enjoy it, too.
For that reason alone, I would vote for Richard Lugar.
There's a lot of reasons to vote for Dick Lugar. But you can do more than vote, Iowa. Lead the nation and take a stand against negative campaigns. Dick Lugar, the right thing for America.
You know, Senator Lugar, when I listen to that ad, I think of the reputation you had as a senator. And I also remember that you spent a lot of time trying to curb nuclear weapons. I wonder if, do you have a reaction to the saber rattling we're hearing now between the current president and North Korea?
Well, I'm really not going to enter into anything that might make that negotiation more difficult than it is already. My own view is that it would have been best, of course, for President Trump to have had more preparation in his public life or private life for foreign policy problems, to understand perhaps better the dilemmas that Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia and I faced when we were meeting with the Russians and began the nuclear threat reduction program. And this required 20 years of taking down the weapons and working through all sorts of diplomatic hassles. But nevertheless, we are where we are, and my hope is that the president will pay attention to what I think are some strong advisors that he has, as well as to some members of Congress who have taken time to think about these problems and to work at them for many years.
Well, I think what made me think of it is that, I mean, you were so popular in Indiana in 2006, the Democrats didn't even put up an opponent against you. But I do also remember that you were very close to President Obama and you worked closely with President Obama. And that was the kind of things that started to enrage the right wing of the Republican Party, the fact that Republicans and Democrats could talk together. And then there was this ad against you in your reelection bid in 2012 by the people who supported Richard Murdoch.
Senator Dick Lugar has earned his title as Obama's favorite Republican. He actually appeared in an Obama campaign ad.
Shout out to Senator Dick Lugar, a Republican to help.
He served as co-chair for Obama's inaugural committee. He also voted to confirm both of Obama's liberal Supreme Court nominees. After decades in office, Dick Lugar has lost sight of the solemn responsibility of his position. Dick Lugar's tenure has come to an end. He doesn't even live in Indiana, and it's time to send him back to wherever his home is.
I'm sure you love listening to that again, and I apologize for that.
Sounds like it was very, very effective.
Well, it was. I mean, it was not even close. But here's what, as I was listening to that ad, I was thinking, you start off in politics by being Richard Nixon's favorite mayor, and your career comes to an end, electoral politics, your career comes to an end as Barack Obama's favorite Republican. There's a little irony in there, isn't there, somewhere?
Well, perhaps, but I would just say Barack Obama came to the Senate when I was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. He was the junior Democrat. He had the at least the goodwill to stay in the room until he got to him to ask his questions and so forth. I complimented him on his conscientious behavior. Whereupon he asked, he said, Dick, he said, I know you go to Russia every summer. I'd like to go with you this time to see the nuclear weapons and what have you. So I took Barack Obama with me in his freshman year in the Senate to Russia. And it was really quite a trip for a good number of reasons, and one of which was we were held by the Russians at one airport. I was being accused of being a spy, and people were trying to get onto our plane and so forth. But in any event, I remember when we got back, Barack Obama said, there's got to be some legislation that comes from our efforts. And so the so-called Lugar-Obama bill was introduced, which was a minor arms control bill or what have you. But In any event, when it came time to the campaign and the debate that he was having there, the presidential debate, he was asked, who do you turn to for advice? Well, he said, if I want financial advice, I call on Warren Buffett. And if I want advice on arms control and politics and defense, I call upon Dick Lugar. I thought, oh, my, I'm listening to this. Nevertheless, he went on to point out the reasons why he had trust of this sort. So I'm grateful that he did, and I did work conscientiously with him and with colleagues from both sides of the aisle. My partnership with Sam Nunn, a Democrat, went on for the better part of 20 years as we took down the nuclear weapons one after another, and Republicans came in and out of power, but we had to get appropriations to get the money to do that job every year. And politics changed. A lot of congressmen and senators came and went during that period of time. I have just found, and I'm still working on this at the Lugar Center with our bipartisan index, that in order to get things done, you really need to work conscientiously with people on both sides of the aisle and to have constructive ideas, to have goodwill, a sense of integrity that people can believe in.
Dick Lugar is a former six-term senator from Indiana, the longest-serving senator in state history. Senator Lugar, it was an honor having you on The Political Junkie and to listen to you talk about a kind of politics that we don't often see anymore in Washington.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to reminisce over years that were very important in my life, and I appreciate the opportunities I still have to boost the good fortunes of those in our public life who are really doing a super job for us.
It was 50 years ago this week, on November 7th, 1967, that Richard Lugar's long political career started when he was elected mayor of Indianapolis. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.